So the question is, okay, so we can get to that depth of realization and understanding, but what is it that really makes this unique self come online? What is it?
Right.
What is the mechanism that allows one to move from selfishness to compassion? It's like I've had quite a few non-dual realizations and causal realizations, and find them all to be extraordinarily interesting. And one is the non-dual realization is non-dual. There isn't any good or bad. Not in, from at one level of divinity. There's combustion. Everything's on fire. Oh my God! This great Buddha's realization. Oh my God! Everything is burning. Everything is unfolding. Everything's in conflict. Okay, well then, how is it that this goodness has meaning from a divine perspective, which transcends opposites? So how is it, what is it that allows us to come online? What is that moment, you know, I'm asking you a question, Mark. What is the moment that
right.
allows someone like myself or yourself to awaken to our own conditions and circumstances and to move to the unique perspective, to move from egocentric self-serving with some lip service to goodness, the actual awakening into bodhisattvahood or into unique self, which is driven by the realization. Because many have got the depth of insight, guaranteed,
right.
but they
right.
still are narcissistic and self-serving
right.
and selfish
right.
individuals.
Yeah, no, that's please go ahead. I'm sorry. So, like, can I jump in for a sec? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Is that, we got the question,
so that's
Mark?
That's a question. You got the question.
Yeah, no, I got you. Got it. Completely got it. Completely got it and appreciated. So, let me focus on one word, the word obligation, right? And the word obligation, it's kind of a great word. I was with my board chair, he's a great guy, a guy named John Mackey, who's a grocer. He started this thing called Whole Foods. And you know, I was at a conference with him a few months ago, and I started talking about obligation, and John actually interrupted me, obligation, I don't believe in that. and John's this very forceful and wonderful man, and he didn't care that the conference was going on. He was just like, I don't believe in that thing, obligation. And so we started this conversation around obligation. And I said to John, you know, in the original Hebrew, right, the word for obligation is chova, and chova has two meanings. It means radical love, and it means obligation. Which is like, whoa, okay, well, there's a koan. Right, let's think about that again. And so one of the things, Jumpo, that's gotten left out, and I feel it so deeply in the integral scene, right, you know, and I feel it also in, you know, a lot of the alternative human potential movement scene, is that we've lost the radical sense of obligation, right? And obligation meaning there's, and that's why this fivefold doctrine of need that I talked about, you know, there's a legitimate need. I recognize the need, right? I have the capacity to meet the need. You know, I'm the only one in the world and the person who can meet that need, right? That, you know, that changes something. It changes something essential because what it does is it says that the actual consciousness of unique self, it is a consciousness which understands, feels, awake, alive, aflame, heart, rend asunder, right, feels this passionate, right, compelling omega point, strange attractor, right, to step into the world and to meet the need that only it can meet as the essential responsibility or the essential obligation of its existence. And what we've done is we've lost that sense. We've lost the sense that, you know, I'm obligated, right? And so even the spiritual path becomes just another expression of narcissism, right? I'm going to kind of become the best meditator. I'm going to become the person with the deepest realization of the great silence. You know, it becomes another deep quality of experience, you know, not that different than great Italian food, right? And we've lost the sense, right, that we actually are co-creative, right, evolutionary catalysts who are obligated to, right, we're obligated to, right, the next unfolding, right, of the good, the true, and the beautiful. And I think what brings it online is this powerful sense of being called and the utter, absolute, radical, horrifying, delightful, penetrating, heart blown open, right, sense of I must do this. This must be done. I cannot die without doing this in everything else that I'm doing in my life, right? Other than this, right, is commentary, is a footnote. If I don't do this, I haven't been alive. I haven't been born, right? I've remained, right, you know, asleep and worse than that, dead, and worse than that, a murderer, because I didn't infuse life and breath into that particular place that could be only infused by me. And what it kind of feels so deeply is that if we can reclaim the sense of obligation, I mean, the reason fundamentalists, Jumpo, and I have so many good friends who are fundamentalists, and they say to me, you know, when they look at kind of scenes like some of the ones that we know, and they say, hey, listen, it's really nice that everyone's really good at theory and they're good at their meditation practice, but none of these people are doing anything to change the world. They're not obligated. You know, you walk into an ultra-Orthodox enclave in Judaism, or you walk into, you know, a kind of good fundamentalist, you know, town, you know, where there's kind of deep sense of kind of big fundamentalist church, you'll see that there's, you know, 50 organizations to help the poor and 60 people with little free loan societies and 70 things for the elder people. And you go into a parallel liberal church, they've got one soup kitchen that meets once a week that some people show up to, right? And it's the sense of obligation is completely different. Right? And so they say to me, you know, you show me a compelling sense of obligation and I'll be willing to listen, right, you know, to your dharma. And so what unique self brings online, uniquely, if you will, is the radical sense of obligation. I'm not only a bodhisattva. I'm not only moved from the Erhart, right, to the bodhisattva, but I am a unique bodhisattva unlike any other, right? And that awakens and enlivens me, right, because I'm addressing a unique need. I feel personally addressed by the infinite, and the infinite personally speaks through me in a way that can't through anyone else, and that obligates me. And that obligation is inexorable. It's utterly joyful, ecstatic. Your beautiful phrase, the title of your book, heart blown open and utterly demanding. And that's the shift. And without that sense of unique self-obligation, it feels like we remain reified in this, you know, kind of hypersensitive or profoundly deep, you know, nuanced, right, sense of beauty and depth and experience, but which doesn't translate into the awakened activist, sacred activist bodhisattva. So that would be my sense of it. So how does that resonate with you?
Pretty good. I still have that gnawing question. For me, it's coming from, you know, what can we do more efficiently than what we're doing to inspire people to move to that greater depth?
So
had a conversation with the Dalai Lama, kind of conversation with the Dalai Lama, where they were complaining about we're second generation teachers in Dharamsala, and we're sitting and he's giving a talk, and the question came up: why are these teachers, you know, having ethical problems and moral problems? Why, you know, why is that going on? There's, you know,
and
one teacher in particular, and he said, "Oh, it's quite simple. His insight's not deep enough." So I raised my hand and I said, "Excuse me, Your Holiness, can I be candid?" And he said, "Please go ahead." And I said, "Bullshit." And he laughed. And I said, "I know this person you're talking of. He's like me, you know. And he studied for years and years. He studied with you. He's did 2-3 year private retreats in caves. He's classically trained. He's a Geshe.
Right.
You know, so how is it that his insight cannot be deep enough?" And he said, "I understand you don't understand that, my son." He said, "That's because your insight's not deep enough." And I went, "No, I know it. They call him the Dalai Lama."
Exactly.
But he was correct.
Right.
So it's like the experience has to be there in my
opinion. Yeah, I get you. Jim, I don't think he was correct. I got to take issue with you. Let's lock swords here a little bit with complete delight and love, right? In other words, and as I've talked to him about this, you know, this question sitting in his bedroom in Dharamsala, you know, and I argued with him about this, you know. In other words, here's where I think that kind of, I want to go back to obligation, my friend, right? And if we don't transmit.
Well, how do you, okay, we're on track here. How can
okay.
you recognize the, what is the mechanic for recognizing the obligation? Just the philosophical construct?
No, it's a transmission, right? You know, it's a transmission. You know, I was sitting a little while ago with a person, I don't know if you know him, I'm sure he's read you and you've read him, and he's a lovely man named John Wellwood, who's kind of written a lot on kind of Buddhism, psychology, wrote a great book called The Psychology of Awakening. And he said to me something like, you know, "Mark, you know, I've heard about you and you seem to be kind of, you know," and he said a couple of nice things. He says, "And I hear that you believe in prayer." Like, how could that be? You know what I mean? In other words, like, you know, an enlightened guy like you, like, why would you believe in prayer? So I said to him, John, like, what do you believe in? So he said, well, I believe in awareness. I said, well, how do you know? He said, well, it's a realization. It's not a concept. It's a realization. I said to him, prayer is the same thing. Right? Prayer is a realization. It's a realization of the second person of the divine. So obligation is the same thing. An obligation is not a conceptual structure. It has a conceptual structure, like the way that you recontextualize and re-philosophize, right, at a certain stage of the mando process that you describe. So it needs, right, a contextual structure. It needs a hermeneutic prism. Right? It needs to be explained, right? But the ultimate depth of it is there's a transmission where you transmit the sense of unique self-obligation. And it's when I look at my student, right, and they look at me and we look in each other's eyes, right? And so what I want to call forth is, right, the enlightened unique self who feels radically obligated to engage in sacred activism with the last breath of being in them. Right? And because I'm calling that forth, and I'm calling that forth not with my personal small self, you know, Gothi power, which is non-existent, but with the power of blown open heart and lineage, right, and with the power of just the inner subjective space and I and thou, what I'm calling forth is obligation. Right, and I'm calling forth the love intelligence that sits in front of me, right, and saying, you've got something to do that no one else can do. You've got a need to address, right, and to transmit that as an awakened realization the same way that you transmit. I know because you've transmitted it to me, right? You know, and as soon as you started talking, I fell into the very first question you asked, what's deep listening? Right, I fell into this infinite silence. I literally, you heard it. You heard me, as it were. I went silent. I couldn't say anything because you transmitted that. So we have to transmit. I mean, you can sit around integral circles or human potential circles, Jumpo, and never even hear the word obligation, let alone the transmission of it. Because obligation is identified as a mythic level consciousness, you know, imposed by an ethnocentric, homophobic God, right, you know, who's not cool in any possible way. So we need to reclaim, if obligation appears emergent from the Mando Zen process, and unique self appears not just as bodhisattva, but as unique self bodhisattva, right? Not unique self on the ego level, right? And Jumpo transmits this realization of unique self. Well, then it's going to awaken. So like
well,
that.
Well, the Mando Zen has five practice mirrors or training elements, and the first one has to do with environmental responsibility and consciousness. You could say, the question is, take a look, honestly, step forward, you know. What is your obligation in relationship to your realization? So that's the actual first question. Show me.
Yeah. I mean, I can give you a pointing out instruction for unique self in two words.
What is it?
Jumpa Roshi.
You got a great sense of humor.
but there it is, right? But it's actually completely true. Right? I mean, it's just like, there it is. Just, we're done, right? Just like I rest my case, right? Jumpa Roshi. Utterly, right? Incommensurably, irreducibly, wildly, ecstatically, heart-blown open, unique. Right? There's no other bodhisattva like him. Right? There's no one saying the Dharma that way. Right? And that's not a function of egoic specialness. That's not, oh, hey, I'm Jumpa, you suck. It's not that. It's the radiant, dazzling, glimmering, shimmering, expansion of all that is as Jumpo. That's unique self. And the reason you're driven, the reason you work, the reason you create is because you feel the sense that I must do this. And it's not that someone's imposing it on you, right? Right? In other words, the injunction, right, which activates you is Jumpo Roshi. That's the commanding injunctive.
There is no choice.
Right.
You know,
obligation. There is no choice.
Yeah. And this is where it gets into karma, you know, karma, the inexorable unfolding. You can struggle against karma, but that, see how far that'll get you. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like I'm being lived, I'm being breathed. This is now, I say it, I've been dead a long time. So this, yeah. You might say the unique self continues. I've been dead for decades.
That's awesome.
That's taking me back to my psychedelic period, but we won't go there. We don't have time.
We don't have time. We can meet tomorrow. see. I mean, what's the litmus test of like a great meeting? I'm just happy now. I'm just happy. You know, just
yeah, I got a big, huge grin on my face.
Yeah, just happy, just happy. Yeah, it's awesome. So I, you know, I know we're kind of we I feel like we just said hello a second ago, right? But we're
wow.
I think we're,
oh
yeah,
my
it's
God,
like
it's almost time.
It's an hour's gone by. Like it's kind of like really. Wow. So maybe just kind of let me be. I just had like a 10-second funny story. I was down at and you know I'll do a little close and then invite you to close and we'll close with that. So this is my close, a little story and an invitation. So I was down teaching with Krishnadas KD. Is this you know a kirtan dude, great guy, and Ramdas, you know the two Das brothers.
Right.
Of course, there's our friend Surya, and you know I was teaching down there, and I mean it's actually a funny story on a lot of levels, but very very briefly, there was like no good food, right? Because you know they're all eating all this healthy stuff, like hello Jumbo, like you know what I mean? Can we get some real freaking food here? Like I'm doing all the teaching. Ramdas of course had a stroke, so he's kind of looking very, you know, kind of fierce, grace, elegant. You know, Krishnadas is kind of chanting for an hour at night, and I'm working all day, and they're feeding me lettuce. So I'm not sure what to do. So like late one night, I go to the refrigerator, and I figure, okay, you know, I'll find something, you know, to eat. So I got this kind of silver wrap stuff, and I'm starving. It's like the end of 8 days. So I get these two huge brownies, and I just stuff them into my face, you know, in the worst eating habits in the world. I'm so relieved that I've eaten something, you know, and then about 7 minutes later, like my entire head starts exploding, you know, and just, you know, and I have no history with psychedelics. I was a yeshiva boy. I didn't know anything about it. And I was just gone. I was just completely gone the entire night. The first hour, actually, I thought I was dying. I didn't know what it was. You know, so I kind of was trying to write my will, you know, and then I realized I'm still alive. I figured I must have been something in that brownie. So about 5:30 in the morning, I kind of, you know, stagger into the living room. Ramdas kind of wheels out in his wheelchair. He says, Rabbi, you don't look good. I said, oh, God, I ate something. What'd you eat? You know, I said, you know, it was at the bottom of the refrigerator. I said, oh, my God, how much of that did you eat? And the moral of the story is don't eat things from Ram Dass's refrigerator. Right?
You know? That's, you know. It helps to be prepared for a powerful disillusioned experience.
It does. Right after that happened, this is the point of the story is, so there's like a little party that happens at the end. And so it comes to this party, Wayne Dyer. I don't know if you've seen his books around. I didn't know him at all. You know, he's sold, I don't know, 20 million books, you know, some insane, you know, amount. And so Wayne comes to the party, and there's 25 people at the party. And Jumpo, this is exactly true. He starts buttonholing every single person in the party, selling his book. And my first reaction, I've got to tell you, was utter disgust. Like, really? You sold 20 million books? You can't relax for a second? And as I watched him, I realized he was right and I was wrong. Like I realized that I was a complete superficial egoic reaction, and I realized as I was watching him tell everyone about his book that he was so ecstatically excited. But what he had, he wasn't trying to make another buck. He was just like, this was his gift. And so there were 25 people at the party, and he wanted them all to have the gift. You know, in other words, it was really kind of beyond, and I kind of gave him a deep bow, and I told him. And so just in that vein, I want to invite everyone on the call to go to Google, right, and, you know, press Amazon, and look for, you know, Heart Blown Open by Jhumpa Roshi. Right, I bought the book a couple of weeks ago, and I've started to read it late at night, and it's just beautiful. You know, the book is fully transmission, fully alive, you know, hilarious in its ways, profound, heart-rending, and just to invite everyone just to go and get that book. You know, and the second book, and this is the Wayne Dyer part, is my book, which is Your Unique Self, The Radical Path to Personal Enlightenment. And I invite you to buy that, you know, from a place of unique self. It's an awesome book. It's fantastic. It'll blow your mind open. Right? It's a totally
it's an awesome book.
Thank you.
Actually, I'm on page 233, and I spid read the rest of it. It's,
oh my God!
It's very, very, very well done, Mark. I'm quite impressed.
Thank you.
You know, you've done a lot of writing, a lot of teaching, but this really draws it beautifully together.
Thank you.
You know,
we
can argue about subtle points, but the overall view is integral and complete and so well done. Thank you.
Deep bow. And so just maybe give us a closing Jhumpa blessing, direction, transmission, you know, whatever should close us or open us.
Okay. Remember, practice is enlightenment. And in these times, keep moving forward. Keep inquiring, broaden your understanding and your perspective. Don't get pigeonholed. right? An integral view. Look at the different traditions. Look at what's going on historically. Open your eyes and clearly see, and open your heart and drink it all in. Evolve and grow. We must awaken. There is no time to hesitate. There is no time to wait. So complete dedication, humility, and fierce loving presence. Practice. Wake up.
Amen. Deep
Amen.
Thank you, Jim. What a pleasure. Love you.
Okay, love you too. Bye-bye.